This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Welcome, everyone, back to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, Shane Told, as I take you into conversations that I have with other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band. Today, we have a New York hardcore legend, Mr. Roger Moret of Agnostic Front.
Why am I going insane? Why am I the one to blame?
Roger should need no introduction. He's one of the founding fathers of New York hardcore. But if you're not familiar with Agnostic Front, their music, or his story, it's definitely unique. Roger was born in Havana, Cuba. His family moved to New York City when he was a kid. He faced a tremendous amount of abuse. He was living on the streets for a while. And as Agnostic Front, you know, became a bigger and bigger band, he actually had to go to prison for drug trafficking for a number of years. Also, despite being of Cuban descent, Agnostic Front was often aligned with white supremacist Nazi skinhead fan base, which is totally, totally insane and something that they were fighting off for years. So there's so much here to talk about. And of course, we couldn't get to anything. Luckily, Roger has a brand new book. It's called My Riot, Agnostic Front, Grit, Guts, and Glory. It is out now. I have read it. It's tremendously interesting. It's such a great book. So make sure after you listen to this, you go and check that out. So a couple weeks back, I gave Roger a call. And the first thing I asked him was where he got the idea to write the book.
Well, I mean, I got to give credit where credit is due when it comes to where how it started. You know, Lars Fredrickson from Rancid, we were in the middle of doing a record, which is Riot Riot Upstart, back in 98, I think. And we're in a studio, and you know, Lars stayed with me for 3 weeks in New York City, and we just talk about the old days, you know.
Yeah.
And then we go to the studio, and we all just, me and Vinny and Rob and all of us just shoot the shit. And he's like, man, Roger, you got some great stories. You need to write a book. You know what? You need to start now, just like that. He goes, we're going to go right now. We're going to get a little tape player, and we're going to record all your stories. And that's how it started, me talking to a little tape player.
And wow,
that was a pure inspiration of it all. And I went through a couple, you know, then I started producing bands, and I had them take all these little tapes and transcript them into like these, what they call floppy disks. Remember those floppy disks?
Of course.
And I still have those floppy disks, which is crazy. And then, you know, printed a couple of stuff, but I didn't get to print at all. And then I lost it twice. I lost it during the World Trade Center, and I lost it somewhere else. And so I switched to Mac. Like I can't keep getting viruses. I'm losing everything. It's starting all over.
Wow.
So to make the long story short, I move over here to Arizona, and then me and my wife started having kids. So that slowed down the process.
Sure.
We started doing the film, and when I was doing the film, Godfathers of Hardcore, that's coming, it's probably be released by end of the year too.
Okay.
Ian's like, well, let me, you know, show me some of the book stuff you have, you know, and I showed it to him. He goes, wow, this is amazing, Roger. You know, I have someone who could help you. I was like, oh, you know, all right, you know, I'll tell him I'll entertain it, but I don't know if I want any help. Sure as hell. Next thing you know, I got a call from John, who's been nothing but the greatest. And he says, hey, Ian just told me you got some great stuff. You know, I'd like to help you. You know, can you send me stuff? I want to read it. And I sent him stuff. He goes, wow, this is really cool. This is great. I really want to help you. And then I told him the same thing I told Ian. I'm like, no, I got to do this. You know, something I want to do myself, you know? So that was about 6 years ago. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Then when we started working on a film again, out of nowhere, John hit me up again. He goes, hey, Roger, did you ever finish that book? He goes, He goes, I like, you know, where are you on it? I want to see where you're on it. And I was like, you know what, John, I didn't do shit. You know, the kids, touring, blah, blah, blah. I didn't, and I was like, you know what, I could really appreciate if you help me out. And then he took whatever I had, put it in some kind of an order, and then we started filling in the gaps, and then we started going further and filling in the gaps. And another 2 years later, here we are. And that's how it became what it became.
Wow. Geez. So yeah, when you finally, I mean, first of all, I've got to ask you about the World Trade Center. You say you lost it in the World Trade Center. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when the World Trade Center happened, you know, everybody wanted to know what the hell was going on. So you start downloading everything and reading everything on the computers, you know, blah, blah, blah. Next thing you know, the virus is being spread, sent around everywhere.
Oh, wow.
And then I had it on my laptop and I had it backed up on my, regular computer. And I used to plug them in at night together, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, I must have opened something up that was some horrible virus or whatever. Sure. And it ate both. It ate on both, you know?
Damn.
And then the second time, I bought this thing called Naturally Speaking Dragon. Are you familiar with that?
No.
It was a program you could buy back in, like, in 2002. It was shortly right after that. And I had to train this, my computer, to actually recognize my voice.
Oh, okay, wow.
And it took like a month and a half for the computer to finally I would read to it like a child. They'll give you stuff to read, and then you go back and it would type it for you, because that's what I want. I want something that would type for me, because I can't stand typing, you know?
Sure, of course.
And then it would type this crazy shit in the very beginning, like, how do you say any of that, you know? So it took a month and a half to train my computer for this.
Wow, my that's laptop. So weird. Yeah.
I remember going on vacation and just reading. I mean, it's just random stuff they give you that make you read till they recognize your voice, you know? So then, same thing happens. I got, I'm doing just on the internet, doing business, doing whatever is going on. Is I got a virus again. Boom, all that got, and I didn't have that backed up. Had it all on the laptop, and all that went to hell too. So it was very frustrating to keep starting over.
Right, but I guess like the action of putting it down, you know, even if it was, you know, years and years before, I think just the action of remembering it, saying it, or typing it, whichever way you did it, is enough to kind of jog your memory, so you know it's still fresh. Because that always happens. Like, I read these books, whether it's, you know, John Joseph's book, or the No Effects book that came out, or your book, and I'm just like, I think to myself, how the fuck do people remember this shit? Like, some of the stuff you're talking about is like, you know, 40 years ago.
Well, you know what else too really helped tremendously, was amazing, is I when you see the movie, you'll put one and one together. But there were a couple items I've had forever that I've just traveled with forever, and you know, it's kind of like memory chests. I have a couple memory chests, basically. That's what they were, and you know, just dragged it along for all these years. I don't know why, you know, just dragged it all these years. Yeah. And starting this film, you know, Ian got me to bring this treasure chest first to CBGBs a long time ago in 2000, one of them. I bought the CBGBs in 2006, right before it closed.
Uh-huh,
maybe 2005 when we shot that last CBGB's video thing.
Yeah.
Ian Shaw, I bought one there, and he was like, holy shit, Roger. And then I showed him everything. He was like, holy shit, you kept all this stuff. And I did. So going through all these memories, I did it again over here when it came to the film. I had another chest, and it just flooded. I mean, it's amazing, because I could pick up a flyer or something and remember something. And it was just, I've had all that stuff for direct contact, direct memories. I could just pick this up and all of a sudden get a flashback of fucking crazy stories, you know? So that helped tremendously, that I had all this stuff in hand, including my old T-shirts, my old punk bracelets, all my flyers, all my posters, all my records. You know, all this stuff really helped tremendously with my brain recognition. But I did find something very interesting along the path of writing this book, and I never thought about it. There was a time where I wanted Amy to make sure everything that I had written was okay, you know, because, you know, just okay by her, you know, because we did have a child together, blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, of course.
And then I sent her, she goes, okay, send me stuff. So I sent her, and the first thing she said, and the first text she sent me was, it's funny how we remember things differently.
Oh, like, yeah, right.
I was like, what do you mean? And she goes, well, I remember different about when we met. And, and I was like, what do you mean? And it's just weird that these are just my memories. I could have been in a room with you or anybody else.
Yeah.
And you would remember something completely different than I did. So that was just mind blowing. I was like, holy shit. You're right. These are just my memories. You know, like not everybody has the exact same memories. So then I started doing some, you know, having conversations with Vinny and recording.
Of course.
Too.
Yeah.
About some of the same situations, and boom, all his memories came to light, stuff that he remembered, which helped in the book tremendously. And the same thing happened with Amy. She came back with some feedback, and she like added candy to it, you know, like remember
Absolutely.
This and this, and then we did this, that. And it was just amazing. It was like just a little bit of a little tweak here and there, and that's how it came to be.
Well, it's amazing, you know, you tell like, it's human nature to do some exaggeration when you tell a story, right? I think everybody does that up to a point. And it's funny when you start to, you know, something happens and then over the years you tell the story over and over again. And sometimes you don't know where it actually, you know, started and where it ended up, which is also a funny thing, right? And then certain details get glossed over. And some of the details are actually important, you know? So that is a totally
absolutely
interesting thing.
Well, you know what else, too, is like some of the details after so many years, so some of the stories are just not real, you know? Like you know, you've heard like there's that chapter, not that they're not real, they're just overblown, over proportioned.
Yes,
it's made out
yes
to be like something like, hey, look, it was just a little thing right here. Now it's just you guys are making out to be like the grand quarrel of ages, you know, like the Boston, New York quarrel thing. It did exist. It was brief.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like what people thought it was, you know, and just clearing up some of the crazy stuff was really cool. Cause I went in and made sure I cleared up when I got into my stories. I wanted to make sure like some of the stuff I've heard over the years, like where'd you get that from? That's insane. You know, it was kind of cleared up, you know?
Absolutely. No, that's totally, totally awesome. Yeah. Well, you've been talking about this film a lot, Godfathers of Hardcore, which is basically, as far as I know, I don't know, I mean, you can explain what it's about, but it's basically just a documentary about you and Vinny. Is that correct?
It's a documentary on the whole band, really, but it focuses on me personally, Vinny personally, our lives separately, and our lives collectively as Agnostic Front. It's not like your VHS 1 documentary. It's a very beautiful film to watch. It's very cinematic. It's very deep. It's very emotional. It's very genuine. It's a beautiful film. And then, of course, it's really cool, super earliest stuff that you've probably, people have never seen vintage footage.
Right.
Because I had some really cool early footage from us at the A7 Club. I had all that stuff on, you know, video, you know what I mean? And I had all these gems. Like I was telling you, I had this chest of gems, you know, and I've had all this stuff. So it's really pretty cool. You know, it's different, but I think it complements the book tremendously. And it's weird because, you know, like my book's finishing and I saw the film and I was like, wow, these two almost walk hand in hand.
Yeah, of
course.
There's
one major thing I purposely left out of my book, and it's pretty much the grand finale of the film. And then when John also saw it too, he's like, hey, Roger, why didn't you ever tell me about this stuff? You know, we talked about everything else. Why? I said, well, because I had told Ian, I wouldn't tell nobody. I kept my secret. I mean, I kept my promise, you know?
Is it weird, like, you know, going through your whole life and yeah, you've kept secrets, you've kept things you never talked about, you've kept things, you know, buried deep inside you, you know, some of the stuff in your book, you know, about the abuse you faced, you know, at the hands of your, you know, your stepfather and stuff. Like, how hard was that for you to share with people? Was it therapeutic at all? Or is it something that you've talked about over the years?
It was very therapeutic to get stuff out.
Yeah.
And then as you keep talking about it, you know, you keep reminiscing on it. You know, just the other day, I was having lunch with my wife, and really, literally, just like 2 or 3 days ago, And I just had, I had a flashback memory back to my Christmas when I was, I think I was 12 or 13. And I remember going into the city. I was living in Union City at the time. And I went to the city because I wanted a boombox. And boomboxes were just starting to come in, you know?
Yeah.
You know, just giant one speaker, like boombox cassette slash. It was when the cassette ones were just, it was cassette V8 of, A-tracks, you know, the combination.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I remember my stepfather taking me to 14th Street, New York City. That's where all the electronics place spots were right before Christmas, going shop to shop to shop, finding one that I liked. So not every memory was horrible, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I told her, I said, you know what? You know what's really funny about it is it wasn't a bad memory. It was actually a good memory. And some of this book has triggered... What, not triggered, it's not the right word, but I mean, what has, you know, like, also, you know, it's not, it was as bad as most of the bad parts are in a book, of course, but there were some good memories too, and I didn't know, I didn't feel them till after I released the bad ones. It's weird.
It is weird how that stuff happens, you know? But, like, yeah, I mean, I think people want to look back at their lives and I don't know. I mean, you want to laugh at the good parts and you want to laugh at the bad parts because now you're okay. You know what I mean? Now it's like, okay, I'm doing well in my life. I have these memories. I have these stories and I learned from them and I am the person I am today.
Exactly. And the most important part is, you know, it's like you could either continue that chain of destruction or do what I did. I broke it. You know, I broke the link, broke the chain, and I decided... At a very young age, anyway, I knew it. I decided that I wasn't going to be anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a decision I made and I stuck to. You know, it's an easy pattern. A lot of people just fall into it. It's a comfort pattern. It's all they're used to. And they're comfortable at it. And it's attention. That the only way for them to get attention. You see, it's a pattern that happens clearly over and over and over. So it's just either you want to end it and move forward or you want to live in it, you know?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. It's just, yeah, your book is awesome. It's real crazy and it's really insightful. And, you know, one thing I wasn't sure if you were going to talk about in the book and you do bring it up is your time in prison. And that's, you know, a crazy time in your life. It basically was in the peak of your career pretty much with Agnostic Front. And you went away for a couple of years and you did time for a drug trafficking charge, I'm sorry. And you don't hold back talking about that.
No, you know, why? You know, what's the point? You know, if I'm going to talk about it, you know, I'm very therapeutic again, because there's a lot of, you know, it's just, I'm a very personal person. I don't like to, I've never been that, you know, like you know, even when you go to shows, like, you know, Vinny's the guy that talks to everybody. He's kind of a mascot, you know, Vinny's just Vinny, you know, and right. I've always been more of an introverted person, more of a personal person. And I guess that's what makes this book really, really interesting. Cause I've always been the guy that doesn't say or speak much besides what's in my lyrics.
Yeah,
that maybe you want to know about, because I am the lead singer of the band, and I've never been much into much of any of the dramas behind the scenes and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So that's what makes it kind of interesting. At the same time, people know I've experienced what I've experienced. I mean, look, think about it. We're talking about what happened in that specific prison stuff. One thing that was super positive that ever came out of that was the album One Voice. One Voice, the whole album front to back has to do with me, why I went to prison, me in prison, me coming out of prison. It's my, I've always told everybody, it's my Pink Floyd, The Wall, my Who, Quadrophenia, if you know what I mean.
Right, sure.
It's like a base, an album that's got, it's based on one thing. I've never done that in any other record. Every other record, it's got a lot of different topics about all different stuff, but One Voice could be a movie, could be that Quadrophenia, could be that, you know, The Wall, because it's one giant story lyrically from start to
concept,
end.
A concept album.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Concept and everything. So I've kind of said everything I wanted to say in that release in that album in many years ago, you know? And then I kind of put it all behind me. But
no,
now
that's great.
And now here I am and giving you more insight to some of the same, some of the stories, because those stories I wrote about some of that stuff, it's clearly like you read New Jack and you could read my book and you're like, holy shit, he has been touching up on this stuff, but lightly. So here I am, you know, I got to really talk more about it in depth about stuff, and actually more in depth about being there and the circumstances of what it was like, you know, and the plain simple fact that my survival instincts from living on the streets, or what I picked up, you know, from my stepdad, you know, toughening me up and getting me ready for whatever the world, that's the way he thought of doing it, was really super helpful being incarcerated, because it didn't, you know, being in there didn't really, not really shock me. It didn't bother me, as crazy as it is to say. What bothered me was the people I was hurting while I was in there suffering or not knowing what was going on. That was what got to me. But I could have, I mean, being in there, the time, it wasn't hard for me to do because of my past experience. You know, I knew this, most of the laws of the streets, and they are also the same laws of being incarcerated. Now, if you go in there and you never knew any of that, that's when you have a tough time. Like, you have to figure it out. But I already had figured it out many years ago. But being the part that I never figured out was what my mom was going to go through, or what Amy or my daughter was going to go through. That's when all the selfishness kind of, when I figured it out that I was very selfish and very, very awful of me to do that to them, you know, because I knew I could deal with what I did to myself, you know? So that was the difference, you know, that was very important for me to get across. And I hope I got that across in a book too.
No, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, it's great that you spell it out. It's funny. Yeah. You talk about, One Voice in that album, you know, and it's, as a songwriter, I'm sure you know, like, you can write a song and you can think you're spelling it out in the lyrics, and people still don't fucking know what it's about. You know what I mean?
Oh, let me tell you something. In our case, in an Agnostic Front, it's been the story of our life. Like, do you not read lyrics, you know? But anyway, yeah, I get you. Yeah, I do get you. A lot of times music changed, and especially in the hardcore and punk and all that stuff. It like there was so much value and meaning of the lyrics. The lyrics were the most important part of everything. Then also became the music being the most important thing. Like, could you feel this groove?
Right.
Dance to this. But can you not? I mean, who gives a shit? You know, listen to what the band is fucking saying. You know, that's the way I've always thought. I thought was that's the generation I come out of. You know,
and absolutely.
Of course, the music compliments is great. It's great that you do both. But don't miss the key factor, you know, the key point.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more of Roger's unique story. This is Shane, the host of this podcast. And first of all, I want to thank you so much for tuning into this thing, whether it's the first time you've listened, whether you've listened to all 94 episodes, whatever we're at. It doesn't matter. Your support here really, really does mean the world to me. When I started this thing, almost 2 years ago now, I had no idea it was going to turn into this. I have so much fun. I've made so many friends doing this thing, and you are the reason that this thing keeps going. Now, not to worry, this podcast will always, always, always be free. However, I wanted to tell you about a couple ways you could throw me a bone and help keep this thing going week after week, and also help this show grow. Now, a lot of people might think I'm just the host of this show. It's actually my baby. I do pretty much everything. I have a little bit help with booking and scheduling the guests, but I do a lot of that myself. I do all the technical stuff. I record it all. I edit it all. I record all these intros. I pick all the music. I write all the questions. I mix it. I master it. I upload it. I write the descriptions. I do the graphics. I do the artwork. I run the social media. I do all of the stuff. And yes, it can be time consuming, but I really do enjoy it. But if you want to help me out, there's a couple ways you can do that. The first way is if you ever buy anything on Amazon at all, use the Lead Singer Syndrome affiliate link. Basically, just go to leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. It'll take you right to the Amazon homepage. And whatever you buy, I get 4 to 6% of your purchase, and it costs you absolutely nothing. So if you ever buy a big ticket item, if you're going to buy a computer, if you're going to buy, I don't know, guitar, Amazon has everything. There's a reason why they're going to open a second location outside Seattle now. They're growing even more rapidly, but it really does help me out. Anything you buy. And I know some people, they do their regular shopping on Amazon. You know, they buy things like paper towels and cleaning supplies and toothbrushes and whatever else. So if you do buy anything on Amazon ever, try to remember. I know sometimes it's hard to remember at the time. Just to use that link, leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon, 4 to 6% of your total will go straight to me. And that does help out with keeping things going around here. Now, the second way, and this is really near and dear to my heart because we just had Sinnerfest this past weekend in Texas, where we had a big meetup with a bunch of the members of the All Access Club. And it was so much fun. I think we had almost 30 people. Shout out to everybody that came. We had people all the way from Sweden, from Costa Rica, from Germany, all the way from Australia. Shout out to Andre, and from Canada. Shout out to myself. Shout out to Trent. And it really was an awesome time. And if you want to be a part of this show, more than just listening to it, you know, every week, once a week, if you want to listen to bonus episodes, if you want to have access to this group where, trust me, you're going to make a lot of new friends, have some amazing discussions about music, about life. If you want more interaction with me, I run a Q&A every month. I play some tunes. And of course, Sinnerfest is not a one-off. We are going to do more events like this. We're going to have more meetups all over the world. And the best part about the club is it costs as little as $6 a month. And I mean, $6 a month, you know, it really isn't too much. That's like one real nice cup of coffee, maybe a couple beers at a bar in like Iowa, and like not even one beer at a bar in New York City. We also have some higher tiers as well. You can get some cool stuff like 3-month patches, merch shipped to your house. Oh, that's another thing. The only way to get Lead Singer Syndrome merchandise is to be a member of the All Access Club. So please check it out. The link is leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. Anyways, thanks for listening to me ramble about that. Let's get back to my conversation with Roger Moret. Well, that's funny. I mean, it's funny you saying that because obviously, you know, the skinhead thing, a lot of people thinking you guys were like basically, you know, especially now it's as relevant as ever with this fucking neo-Nazi shit going on, craziness. But that was a big problem. A lot of people thought you were like a white supremacist band. Meanwhile, you're like, I'm Cuban. You know, it's that's like you talk about people not getting it.
Well, that mean I didn't have any help. The fact, simple fact that there was also someone else kind of bringing that full on attention to us. And they didn't even know. I'm talking about like Maximum Rock and Roll. They didn't even know the damage they were doing.
Wow.
It's easy to talk about stuff and accuse people of stuff and say stuff, but then you're safe. You're doing it all from your house and you're not there living it. And then you got to actually face sometimes these situations, which are very dangerous, you know?
Yeah,
it's so it's easy to talk about shit, but where's the action, you know? And the action was what we had to live with and deal with, you know? And you know, and it was also, 80s were a very confusing time, too, for a lot of people. Music started to get, politics really started heavily hitting the scene, which was something that, or the division of politics, because, you know, obviously, you know, I come from a time where politically incorrect was correct, if you know what I mean.
Totally.
You know, and then all of a sudden political correctness comes along and all the old punks and all the people that have been around for a while just didn't quite fucking get or understand it. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is the way punk is. You know? Have you ever heard of the Sex Pistols, you know, or shit like that? I mean, if you think about it, the Sex Pistols would be a band today. They wouldn't even make a tiniest of the impact they made in 1976. In fact, the internet would fucking destroy them overnight. With
You're not wrong. No, I know.
Really? So there's a giant difference here. And I was trying to make that clear in a book too. Also, like, you know, like, hey, you know, back then, by the time we found out things, it wasn't like I woke up today and found out something overnight, you know. No, it took months. It took months for a record to get from England to New York. Months, 3 months, because it came by a damn boat, you know, and very slow, and to the West Coast. And, you know, it was just, it wasn't like what we have today where, you know, overnight you hear the whole damn record. Somebody put it on the fucking internet overnight. So, you know, and it's, and that's how everything was back then. It was, made things a little bit harder for people to tune into stuff, you know, because the last information they got was 3 months old or 4 months old by the time they got new information, and things are changing, you know? So it was just a really different time. The 80s were a very difficult time for a lot of people, and a lot of people that survived it, I'm glad they did survive it. You know, a lot of people made a lot of bad choices, including myself, you know, obviously, and some people turned their lives around, which I look up to people that turned their lives around that had a ruthless life or weren't there altogether or went on some crazy mission that then they finally saw the light. You know, you got to give respect for that too, you know, because that's happened to me physically, and I could relate to people like that.
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's funny you bring up that, you know, because, you know, you talk about Agnostic Front, you talk about Madball, you talk about all these bands. It's like, that's New York hardcore. That was a scene. That was a sound. You guys were all, you know, in the same scene playing with each other. And, like, California might as well have been the fucking moon, you know, back in the 80s. Yeah. And England might as well have been Mars. Like, these scenes were all so separated. I think that's really hard for young people to understand. And, right. And it was, and not only was it far away when there was a disconnect with the music, obviously music sounded different in these different places, but there was also a different way people lived. You know, even D.C., you talk about D.C. hardcore and their, you know, moral fiber that didn't exist in New York.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And even just going to California for the first time ever. And I went to California. I never seen so many punk gangs in my life.
Yeah. I mean,
there's bands that they come out of, like, but like, for instance, TSOL used to be a punk gang before, you know, TSL the band, you know, and it's suicidal. You know, just think about all this stuff, you know.
Absolutely.
And I've never even seen anything like that until I went there, and I was like, holy shit, what the fuck is this? And that's because
we thought we were hard.
Well, it's just different. Like, they were living different. That was what they were doing. And it's, you know, you could read about it here and there, but you never really got grasp it till you actually physically saw it. You're into fucking shit. You know what I mean? And that's how it was back then. You know, we had no, you know, and I would have never known if I never went to California. You know, I would have been in my own little bubble in New York City. Like you said, might as well be Mars, you know.
Right.
That's exactly what it was. And, you know, and the only way we knew about anything is when a record would come out or when some kind of a scene report or some band would come around and we'd just start chatting about stuff and you find out different little things. You're like, wow, I didn't know this. I didn't know that, you know. Not like these kids today, they're fucking pretty much everything's at their fingertip. It could be a little spoiling if you think about it. But at the same time, it made those times so magical because it was so much of the unknown that was so much, it was so cool to explore, where a lot of that excitement is gone now because now you get that everything overnight.
Yeah.
Where back then you need to explore. It's like going into a cave and finding different rooms, different treasures. And it was really fucking cool, to be honest with you. Just buying that record and finding other bands was amazing. And, you know, the only World Wide Web we had were actually physical letters that you wrote to other people, other bands, or, you know, just find out stuff or, you know what I mean? It was,
sure.
It was really amazing.
No, absolutely. No, I always think that stuff is so interesting. You know, it's like, in, you know, nowadays you hear a band and it's like, oh, you know, it used to be like even in the 90s, you'd hear a band and you'd say, okay, I can listen to this band. I'm like, can pretty much tell, oh, they're probably from Southern California or they're probably from New York, just based on the music, based on the way the band sounds. Now you hear a band, it's like, you probably just assume they're from like Ohio or something, you know, like,
well, you know, what was also great about back then is like, every band had their own style, just like you said, their own sound. And, you know, like, it was just amazing. Like, it was just, like, so personal that way, where all of a sudden then there's a lot of bands, and, you know, and then you don't know where bands are from anymore or nothing like that. You just, it takes a lot more. But it's cool because, you know, like, our initial intent was to get the message and our music to be heard as much as possible. And it did just do that, you know. But at the same time, like, you know, it's easy to mimic a sound. It's easy to mimic something. But, you know, it's the hardest thing that you could ever, and you can't just get, is living that life. You know what I mean? And that was what was different, you know. And that's what made Agnostic Front stand out and stuff like that. Or from, because we were actually, you know, the New York hardcore bands or some of the grittier cities that, like San Francisco bands, yeah. That you could listen to those sounds and they're a little grittier, a little uglier. And that's because life was a little uglier, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing.
In some of these places. I'm not saying it wasn't in L.A., because it sure as hell was.
Yeah.
But there were different. It was very gang territorial, very suburban, as opposed to very urban, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just different sound, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things in your book that really struck me as a crazy thing to go through was basically raising your kid, you know, basically in a squat in New York City, which I guess was what ended up stemming, you know, into, you know, your problems with being incarcerated. But that part of the book is so striking to me, and it's so real. Can you walk me through that, just that time in your life? Because I found that was one of the parts of your book that really jumped out at me.
Which part again? I'm sorry.
About how you were raising, you know, a child basically in a squat, you know, in New York City.
Well, you know what? As dangerous, as crazy as it really was, and it sounds, I don't know. It was kind of safe because it was a safe haven for me. It's weird. I don't know how to explain it. Same with, you know, bringing my brother, who was at the time 6 years old, the first time ever, and staying with me. In those circumstances, you know, taking him from at that point, a suburban home in Florida and bringing him into the jungle. Right. But believe it or not, the jungle was safer because he didn't have to go through the abuse I had to go through.
Yeah.
That's the main reason why I wanted to keep him safe. And so you would be surprised in how much safer it was for a lot of us, because a lot of us, when we came together, we were all like a bunch of misfits, a bunch of outcasts, you know. Mostly from troubled families. And the only thing that we found comforting was being together and going to these shows together. And we naturally became some kind of a tribe, you know what I mean? Like, we felt we needed to protect each other, and we did. Family, those family matters, those family instances, stuff I talk about today, were very strong and personal and, you know, gave us that tribe feeling, you know. And we protected each other, and I had the same feeling with raising my family in the squats, because I knew I was amongst other people.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like that lion that whole time, and we knew what we were doing. We just think, you know, it's different when you don't, and you throw yourselves in a line of danger because you just are not, you're not in tune with it. And I've always been in tune with it, you know what I mean? And that makes the difference, you know. It's like street smart, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, absolutely, man, absolutely. So, you know, it's funny because I'm young, a lot younger than you. You know, I'm only 36, like I said. And the first time I heard Agnostic Front, I was about 17 years old, and it was on the Something's Gotta Give record. And, you know, you guys came out, and it was kind of like your comeback, you know, on Epitaph Records. And there had been a lot of punk rock, I guess, had gotten big in the mainstream, you know, with like Green Day and Offspring, and those bands had blown up. And it was like, right, all of a sudden, hardcore legends Agnostic Front have a new record, and the first song I ever heard by you guys was Gotta Go. What was that like for you, basically having this comeback and having just seeing punk all of a sudden be so mainstream? Was that something that you appreciated, you thought was cool, or was it like just not the same as like, you know, the victim in pain years?
No, I mean, look, I've always said, if you turn on the radio or whatever, wouldn't you rather hear Rancid, Offspring, Green Day than half the shit they play anyway, you know? So
absolutely.
And
yeah,
you know what? What's more important than all of this is that people are quick to turn their backs on. I've seen it happen earlier. I mean, didn't the Clash go through this? You know, like, I was there when the Clash went through it. I was there when London Calling came out. I was that snotty punk kid that hated London Calling. It took me a long time to like London Calling. I thought they sold out. It took me 2 decades maybe to like that fucking record, because I fucking love the first, you know, the first two Clash records. And then I realized, you know, I went back and revisited it. I was like, fucking lyrically, it's the same fucking, these bands never change what they were meaning to say. Their music would have changed. It's part of growth. And you know, I experienced that myself with Agnostic Front.
Right.
And then when I go back and see, and I was like, man, you know, ignorance is, you know, we all have a little ignorance, we all have a little bit of ego we have to deal with within each other. And I started to see a lot of this stuff, you know, as I got older. You know, I checked myself in a lot of stuff. And going back to what you just said, you know, these bands have always stayed true. It's not their fault. It's really not their fault they had major success.
No.
That a lot of people like their songs. Jesus, that's amazing. You know, that they wrote something passionately, that they, about their lives or something, and their life has always been passionate and dedicated to punk, and it's not their fault a lot of people like it. And it's weird, I guess, being one of those bands and going through it, but most of those bands have remained true to their roots, you know, and they're giving people a lot of things to think about, which regular radio music totally avoids, and they don't want you to think. The last thing they want is anybody to think for themselves. They want everything to be dominated by the MTV or the whatever huge record labels, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So these bands, you know, not knowing what was going on, it was just an explosion. But for some reason, you know, it was kind of a trickle also off of the Nirvana situation.
Ah, right. Yes.
The whole let's not forget that. Let's not forget the whole grunge thing, I guess. It trickled down because a lot of these, all of a sudden, we went from all this hair rock giants to this grunge thing, which then all the grunge bands, of course, started talking about all the bands they were in, their past bands, and where they come from, which is more like hardcore punk.
Right.
And then that's the next thing that happened. You know, like people, those fans started, oh shit, what's this?
That's
and,
right. Yeah.
You know, it was a trickle down. A lot of people don't
no,
see that.
No, it's actually not really talked about very much at all. I mean, you think about like Dave Grohl, you know? I mean, he was a hard DC hardcore kid, you know?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I played with Dave Grohl. I mean, I didn't play with him. I remember doing shows in Rhode Island was the last time we played together, if I remember, when he was in Scream playing drums, you know?
Yeah.
So these are all people that we grew up together with, getting a little bit of success and at the same time in shock. Let me tell you, like, I know these bands personally, and they had to deal with shock. They didn't know what to think of it. A lot of these bands wanted to fight it because it wasn't what it was, you know. I felt the same way. I've never thought that punk was a stadium thing. I've never been to it. The only stadium rock show I ever went to was The Clash at Shea Stadium, I think it was 1982. And I went to go see The Clash, and it was the Who was playing too, and I was one of those ignorant punk kids that walked out after The Clash, because I was one of those cool ignorant punk kids.
Yeah.
And I've never seen The Who, and to this day I regret it. The second time The Who went to play, I was locked up, and I saw it in the papers in prison. I was like, fuck. And that was it, you know?
Right. But I mean,
anyway,
yeah,
a lot of these bands didn't even know what was happening or didn't know how to deal with it, you know? And look what happened to, what's his name, bro, from Nirvana, Nirvana, you know?
Kurt Cobain, yeah.
Yeah, he just, that was total shocking. He just didn't know how to accept it. But, you know, the music was very genuine, very sincere, and
yeah,
it's not
you're
their
right.
fault that the media grasped to it, man.
No,
and,
no.
You know, a lot of people are quick to, like, you know, attack. But they should think about stuff, you know?
No, I totally agree with you. I guess my question for you is just the way you grew up, you know, with, you know, New York City hardcore, CBGBs, all that. All of a sudden, it's 1998. You put out a record on Epitaph, which has The Offspring, has Rancid, has these bands that are getting played on MTV and are getting huge. And I mean, maybe not playing stadiums, but playing big, clean venues. Some of them are like in the suburbs, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what was that like for you? Were you like, this isn't punk rock? Like, this is not what I know? Or were you like, nah, this is cool? I guess that's my question.
Well, no, because a lot of my, also H2O was on.
Yeah, H2O, yeah.
Sorry. I mean, and I knew Brett. It wasn't that. Sorry. It didn't feel that way to me. Because understand also this, a lot of those bands were also West Coast bands.
Yeah.
And most of the, most of the West Coast bands have always been a lot more popular and always had a lot more success. The West Coast has got this different thing than the East Coast.
Yeah.
East Coast is a little bit dirtier. And kind of not, you know, West for some, you know, like, it's just different, you know. It's just, and the music scene on the West Coast has always been a lot bigger. It really has been, you know. Oh, really, like, if you think of all the bands from the West Coast and how much bigger it is in the East Coast, with the exception of your Dropkick Murphys nowadays, you know.
Right, right.
That's a rarity. And so, to me, I was in a band with my peers, you know, my friends. I was with a band with the Bouncing Souls. On a label with the Bouncing Souls, with H2O and Rancid and even Offspring. I didn't really know how much it was. I didn't really get to know what it was going to become.
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of living in it, you know, but not knowing. To me, I never thought it was directly going to affect me, if it's probably the best way to put it.
Cause, yeah.
You know, our music, I've always said Agnostic Front has always been the true aborted child of punk, you know, because I mean, music's ugly, it's not pretty, and it's really not poppy or not really meant for the masses, I guess. It is what it is.
No, but I think that epitaph, you know, that machine, that 90s punk, whatever, yeah. Green Day Offspring machine, that actually really helped, you know, a lot of kids, including myself, go back and find out those records. Like, I wouldn't know Victim in Pain or Cause for Alarm. Like, I wouldn't know those records if I didn't hear, you know, you guys on a Punk-O-Rama comp. Like, that's just being real, you know?
That's what I try to explain to a lot of people. Like, a lot of people think, you know, not everybody was born with tattoos and cool parents, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And then they treat you like when those first kids, like when you go to these Warp Tours, and they talk shit on the kids from that. They go to that music store in the mall. I forgot what it was called.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but they don't understand that, you know, that was maybe you at once in your life, you know? And you need to somehow, you discover, like, maybe it was your Green Day. Green Day's huge now. Maybe you went to Green Day and you saw Degeneration and, wow, that was your change. Or you went to a festival, you went to the Warp Tour to see...
The Offspring, sure.
The Offspring, and then all of a sudden you saw Madball, and you saw Sick of It All. And that's how it works. It doesn't mean that you don't like The Offspring anymore, blah, 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 but now you discover something, you're moving around, and you're finding something that you feel is more of a direct contact to you. It may never even appeal to you. You may hate Agnostic Front, Sick of It All, Madball, which is true, and you still love The Offspring. There's nothing wrong with it. But, yeah, it's ignorant to think that. And when that's what happens generally, like, you know, these are the uncool kids and these are the cool kids. And that's retarded. It's just straight up.
No, it's dumb, funny. And I've spoken a lot of that on the show. Like, I went to my first Warped Tour in 1997. I went to see Lagwagon and Pennywise. And the first band I saw, the first band I saw was Sick of It All. At Warped Tour 1997, and they did it this year. So,
and what was your impression?
I thought it was the sickest thing ever. I was like, this band is...
Right?
I looked up at the stage and
you would have never known unless you went to that damn Warped Tour to go see who you went to go see. And that's what I mean.
No,
if you got... And that's that innocent mind that you had, an innocent, like, creativity. You wanted to learn, like we had back then, but we had only records to do that shit with.
That's right. No, I looked up on
really cool.
I looked up on the stage and I saw Pete, and I was like, that's the craziest looking motherfucker I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny, in the foreword of your book, even Jamie Jassa talks about, like, there was you had a tattoo on the back cover of your record or whatever it was. And he's like, I need to hear this band. Like, this is crazy shit, you know? It's just wild, you know, how you know, even Jamie Jasta was a little, you know, was a little kid, right? And now he's, you know, now he's this hate breed machine. Right. It's crazy, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, like, you were going back to some of the stuff you were talking about earlier about all the bad publicity and bad stuff. And also, you know, bad publicity is sometimes as good or better than good publicity.
Right.
Because it got people to go out. Hey, let me go see this Agnostic Front band. Let me see what they're all about. And next thing you know, we have big crowds. And then they're like, holy shit, this band's cool. Best thing I ever did. I had a great time.
Right. And then they realize you're not a racist band. You're
right.
Actually,
and
you're actually uplifting.
I always said, as long as they spell the name right, you know?
Well, that's always a challenge.
That publicity works a good. I'll deal with the people directly in front of me, and, you know? but it is what it is, you know?
Absolutely, man. No, I know I got to let you go. I know you got another interview after this, but I want to thank you so much for your time, for doing this. It's really great to talk to you. What's going on next for you? Obviously, the book is coming out. I assume you're doing some book, you know, signings and stuff. And then are you doing some shows with Agnostic Front? What's going on? What's coming up?
Yeah, well, where are you located at now?
I'm in Toronto.
Oh, Toronto. So we're going to be near you, but not really near you. We're going to be in Buffalo for
a show. Pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, show book signing thing where I do both in September. We're also celebrating our 35th year anniversary.
Nice.
Agnostic Front is.
Congratulations.
And so we're doing a little combination of 35 year anniversary and celebration of the book. So it's kind of cool. Just a couple selected dates, and one of those is going to be in Buffalo in September, I believe. So cool. If you get a chance to make it come down, if you get the book, bring it down. You know, I'll be doing some book signings, whatever, at the shows and meeting people. But that's what's next, pretty much. The journey of our 35-year anniversary, the celebration of my book, and then the grand finale of the film, hopefully by the end of the year. And I think that calls for a really great year for us, you know? The only thing that could top it all off would be a new album, but hey, one thing at a time, you know?
Well, and all the best, man. Congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the movie coming out.
If you don't mind, plug all the Agnostic Front, like Agnostic Front Facebook, my personal Roger Moret, my Instagram, to people staying connected with us, or lessergodsbooks.com. That's all important networking nowadays.
Absolutely.
We just spoke about it, you know, but it is what it is, you know?
It is what it is. And yes, man, no, thank you. I will definitely put a link to your book and a link to all this stuff so everybody can check it out. Roger, thank you so much. Enjoy your morning out in Arizona. And yeah, stay cool, man.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, take care.
Take care.
So there it is with Roger. What a guy. What a life. He's doing so well out in Arizona right now. Shout out to him and his wife. And his book is out now. So go pick it up. My Riot, Agnostic Front, Grit, Guts, and Glory. It is not to be missed. Next week, I will be back with an all-new episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. We're getting close to the 100-episode mark. Some big things planned once we hit triple digits. I'm excited. I hope you're excited. Please, please subscribe to this thing. If you like the show, write a review on iTunes. And of course, if you want to get in touch, it's real easy. We're on all the social medias, Lead Singer Syndrome. Pretty much just search for it in whatever. It'll pop right up. And if you want to email me, I do read all of my email. I'm not great at getting back, but I do read it all. It is leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I'm out of here. I'm going to leave you with a tune. I'm going to talk about that song, Gotta Go, I guess it's called, which was basically the Agnostic Front comeback. So here it is, Gotta Go on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. See you next week.